Our next guest on the program writes about comedy for the New York Times. He's the author of Searching for Dave Chappelle and a brand new book entitled Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Jason Zinnemann joins us this afternoon. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It is an absolutely wonderful, fascinating book and a look at one of the most certainly unique people in the history of television. Although you suggest that maybe our observations of Letterman aren't what they appear to be, that perhaps in his mind he was a traditional host in the midst for many years of a non-traditional show.
Well, it's one of the questions that I started this book with, which is that how did this guy, who I always thought was such a renegade, such an innovator, someone who was always going against the grain, doing a show that would seem to be the antithesis of what Tonight Show was, why is it that in every interview I saw with him, he talked about his reverence for Johnny Carson? That Johnny Carson was his model and his hero. And as great as Carson was, it seemed like, to my kid's eye watching the show, that he was in opposition. Letterman was in opposition to him. And so part of one of the things I try to report out in the book is why, you know, how did this show come from somebody who was trying to do Johnny Carson? And you know, part of the answer is he did take some things that Carson did, like the way Carson would save a joke that bombed, which Carson was magnificent at. Letterman also did a similar thing. But also he had other people on his staff who kind of pushed him into embrace his more kind of irreverent sensibility at times. So, you know, the how Letterman's show became what it was has obviously mostly to do with him, but it also has to do with the people around him.
And one of those most important influences was his partner, in both professionally and personally in the early days. Meryl Marco was really the one who had an idea of what she wanted that show to be.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, she started writing for him when he was a stand-up comic and wrote, was an incredibly prolific joke writer and had a mind for literate and conceptual humor that found its way onto The Morning Show and The Late Show. And, you know, she's the one who came up with Stupid Petrix and Viewer Mail, you know, which, with the exception of, say, the top 10 list, are probably the bits on that show that endure longest.
And he was willing to go along with a lot of these things, even though he sometimes wanted to do something a bit more traditional. And obviously, it proved to be a great success. It was so very different than everything else. But there was also the idea that you could do things later at night than you could get away with if you moved to an 11:30 slot.
Yeah, that's one of these things that I think people who grew up today don't kind of understand to the same extent that people who are grew up with just three networks do, which is that 12:30 at night was much later in 1982 than it was today. If you were somebody who had an interest in irreverent comedy in 1982, 83, 84, you pretty much had one option, and that was Late Night with David Letterman. So all kinds of different people watch David Letterman. Well, today, you know, the internet is going 24 hours a day, there's streaming, there's endless number of options for people who like offbeat humor. And I think that's part of the reason that one, Letterman seemed, but also you had to stay up late to see him. You couldn't, you know, James Corden, a lot of his show is seen the next day on YouTube. But for Letterman, you had to stay up late. It was sort of like the old midnight movies where you see Rocky Horror Picture Show, that it felt like you were an event. It felt like you had to make effort to go see it, even when you were sitting at home. I know I did as a kid. I had to kind of like stay up past my bedtime and, you know, sneak out to the TV room and turn it on, you know, before there was their remote control. What I found is in the reaction to this book is that a lot of people have the same experience, that it almost seemed like there was something a little dangerous about this show, a little forbidden, and a little hard to figure out what was going on. That, you know, it was the show had a kind of elusive quality that gave it the feeling of an inside joke that I think really made people who are committed to it, diehard fans, really identify strongly with it, and it meant a lot to them.
And as you write, the Letterman of those NBC days was a pretty active participant in what was going on, was in the writer's room, and was wanted to know what was happening. And that was a very different David Letterman than what we saw at the end of his CBS days when he even stopped rehearsing.
Yeah, I think, you know, he was never... I think he was never always in the writer's room, you know, kind of that was separate. But I do think he became more remote from the show, and certainly towards the end of his run, as you said, you know, I think in 2000 he had a heart attack or a heart problem, and after that he stopped going to rehearsal, and that meant that you know, if you were going to run jokes by him, run an ambitious piece of material by him, you'd have to do it much later on, which I think changed the ambition of the show to some extent. And now what he would say is that the show became more about him off the cuff, him having conversations with people, him his ad-libbing, which there's no question is one of his strengths. And part of what I think distinguished him in his later period from everything else on television.
We're talking with Jason Zinnemann, the author of Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. The whole move to CBS has been well documented, his desire to get that Tonight Show. And I thought it was fascinating that I think it was one of the NBC execs who says in the book that it was really his agent at CAA that maybe kept him from getting that, because he set the bar so high in terms of not only salary, but ownership of the show, ownership of the show that followed as well.
Well, this is, again, one of these Rashomon stories where every person you talk to has got a different take on it. And, you know, everyone, there's so much money and legacy at stake that you have to be skeptical of what everyone says. I think there was this very, you know, complex set of negotiations that went on during that period. And Bill Carter wrote about this beautifully in his book, The Late Shift. But going back to some of those sources now, I think, you know, that there is a case. You know, one thing that Mike Ovitz said, who was his agent, who was kind of a, you know, incredibly powerful agent at that time, is, you know, he said that from the beginning, you know, he saw CBS as the best choice. And I think that was quite telling, because Letterman's stated position was that he wanted Tonight Show above all else and would have taken less money, et cetera. So while there's a whole elaborate series of machinations before the begin when they first sign up to where he went to CBS, I thought the fact that Mike Ovitz said that was pretty revealing.
The show changed in so many ways when he moved to CBS, and you point out one of the things was that he could no longer be the underdog. The show was funded quite well by CBS. It was a pretty lavish production, and I thought it was interesting that several people commented that even the size of the studio changed the nature of how they operated.
Yeah, I think that was there's many reasons why the show changed. I don't think any of them are more important than that. It seems mundane. You know, it just seems like, oh, it's just a bigger room, but there was something about that old show. It was in this kind of cramped studio. It had a very particular sound. No other show on television sounded quite like that. And part of that was intentional. Paul Shaver actually didn't play music for all the guests who came on. And sometimes if a joke didn't work, it would be very quiet in a way that a big production would not be. But I also think that the size of the theater allowed for a kind of more intimate style. Then when you move to Ed Sullivan Theater, which is really something closer to like a traditional Broadway stage, it's not quite that big, but it's almost 500 seats. I think it did change the feel of the show, and certainly Letterman is a performer who cared a lot about what the people in the room were responding, how they were responding. And so if the punchlines needed to be hard, it needed to get a response, the amount of kind of non sequitur, bizarre humor decreased, and I think there's many reasons for that. But one of them is certainly moving to a huge stage.
And he certainly changed his approach in those later years as well. And it's ironic that a guy known originally for his detachment from things and for not revealing much about himself is in many ways, especially to an audience perhaps under 40, remembered most for maybe the two moments when he revealed the most about himself, and that would be the first show after 9/11 and the show when he came back after his heart surgery.
Yes, for sure. I think it's incredible. You're absolutely right. And I think it's both surprising and ironic, but at the same time, I think they're related in that, you know, Letterman established himself as the kind of the ultimate detached ironist whose sense of humor came from the point of view of somebody who was guarded, who didn't reveal all his emotions. So when, after 9/11, he was willing to be vulnerable and express his confusion and or other times when he expressed his neuroses, you believed it in the way that somebody who was always doing that, always being emotional, you might be a little more skeptical of. It had a power because it was coming from him. So when a guy who's relentlessly ironic becomes very sincere and earnest, it's potent. And I think the same thing is true. I mean, I think that's definitely true after 9/11. I think he gave the most eloquent and, galvanizing broadcast of any of the late night hosts after that. And it's also true after the heart surgery. You see recently Jimmy Kimmel gave the speech about healthcare, which had to do with his son, which was very resonant and which got a lot of attention. That speech, I think, owes a lot to that Letterman's heart surgery speech. Like Letterman, he named his doctors and nurses. I couldn't help but notice that the first sentence of that Jimmy Kimmel monologue, he said something along the lines of, I have a story I want to tell you.
Right.
Which is the exact same way that Letterman started his speech where he talks about his blackmail affair. A guy like Kimmel, who is, an unabashed Letterman devotee, you see the influence of Letterman quite overtly with him.
He obviously is revered by people in the industry as well as by fans, but a difficult guy to work with, and it seemed like through the years didn't make a lot of friends among his colleagues, even Paul Schaefer, who worked with him for so long. That was a show relationship, certainly more than it was a personal relationship.
Well, I wouldn't go. That's a little bit farther than I would go. I mean, I think Letterman in some ways is very loyal. Paul Schaefer was on that show for a long time. That's an unusually long relationship in television and show business. There are other people who were there from the beginning as well. I do think that Letterman, until fairly recently, what many people told me was that, he didn't have this huge circle of friends. He wasn't going out to parties. He wasn't, this gregarious extrovert. He was a fairly shy, introverted guy. Who towards the end of the show was kind of cordoned off from the rest of the people on the show. I mean, that was sort of when I started this project. I think one of the first hints that this was going to be a very tricky reporting job, but also a very fascinating one, is that I talked to one writer who's worked there for a decade and a half, and he said he'd only met Letterman a small handful of times. Consider that what's the people who hardly ever met their boss, someone who they're writing jokes for every day, that's enough for me.
We're talking with Jason Zinnemann. The book is Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. You talked with David Letterman. Is he happier now that he's not doing the show?
This is a question I can't, it always ends up sort of through speculation. I'm not inside his head, but my read on it is he seems happier than he's ever been. And just observing him showing up at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame introducing Pearl Jam, or showing up at a Capitals game, and the amount of appreciation people have, the sense that the interest in Letterman has not dimmed at all. If anything, it's increased in the era of Trump. When I interviewed him, he seemed incredibly relaxed and forthcoming, and at peace with retirement. He was a very charming, introspective guy. He did not seem, here's somebody who had the weight of a nightly national show and millions of audiences to contend with for 33 years, and he seemed like someone who, had dropped that weight and was relieved for it.
I thought it was very interesting, too, that, as you say, he had a slightly different background than most of those other great late-night hosts, in that he was primarily a broadcaster.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, he always described himself, right, as a broadcaster, not as a stand-up comic, and I think it had a huge impact on his career. I mean, one thing that, I think is important is that when Letterman was born, there wasn't a TV in his house. Radio was the first thing, was his first love. He wanted to be a radio star. He listened to the radio hosts, and his first broadcasting job was in radio. And I think you know, working in radio, you know, as you know, you know, you develop different skills. You have an appreciation for language. You have to, you know, your storytelling needs to be very refined. And I think that Letterman always was fascinated and respected broadcasters, you know, whether it's Larry King or Regis Philbin or Bob Costas. These are people, Howard Stern, people he had on his show repeatedly. He also really, I mean, he also had great respect for his predecessors, you know, Steve Allen, Jack Barr. But he, I think it's notable that he identified as a broadcaster and not as a comedian. Or he knows, but he identified first as a broadcaster.
So what is his legacy in the history of late-night television?
I think his legacy is a couple things. I think, first of all, I mean, just the sheer longevity can't be underestimated. I mean, you know, I don't know if someone will be on television that long again. Two, I think he really mainstreamed a certain kind of ironic sensibility in the 1980s that has now become so pervasive. Three, I think, you know, he kind of developed in that same decade a vocabulary of comedy for television with things like the remotes, you know, how he would cut interactions with people on the street together to make a comedy bit, stuff that you see on Conan O'Brien's show or The Daily Show, where you just take it for granted that it was always there. Letterman really perfected that form. And so, I think those, you know, are main as well. You know, the last thing I would say is that, you know, he was an incredibly fascinating person. And I think for the later stages of his show became as much about his own personality and finding comedy from his character. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, his greatest accomplishment is the same accomplishment that any artist has, which is that he, through his medium, which was talk show, revealed himself. And in revealing himself, he was a fascinating, compelling figure, one of the most fascinating, compelling figures in the history of television.
Well, it's an absolutely wonderful book. We appreciate so much you making time to talk with us about it. Jason Zinnemann, the book is called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Jason, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
It's been really fun. Thanks for having me.